The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties and many of those under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first out-of-state property in the next 4 months, then I encourage you to check out my free training that'll break down the process and show you exactly what it takes to invest out of state. I purchased properties out of state and it's changed my life. The same is possible for you. You simply need the right information. My free training will help you take that next step towards buying your first out-of-state property. You can watch the training right now at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode. Again, you can find it at outofstatemoney.com, or you can click the link in the description of this episode.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second?
Yes. This is the Black Real Estate Dialogue, and the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
The reality for a lot of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. Here's the good thing though. Around the country, there are so many cities with affordable investment properties, some even under 100,000, so there's a lot of opportunity out there. On September 20th, I'm starting a four-week virtual intensive workshop that'll show you how to buy your first out-of-state property. So we're gonna go over everything from creatively financing that first property, how to build your team that you can trust, how to find and analyze properties, and how to find the right location, and so much more. You deserve to build wealth for your family. You deserve to invest in real estate. It's simply a matter of getting the right information. So I want to see you there. If you're interested, go to outofstatemoney.com/workshop or click the link in the description of this episode. I'll see you there. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 184. A few quick announcements before we get into this week's episode. If you haven't already, do me a huge favor. Leave a 5-star rating and review wherever you are listening to this show. It helps us get seen by more people and spread this important message all over the world. And if you do that, I got something for you. I will send you a free training on how to find and evaluate property. So if you're a beginner or you're not sure how to look at the cash flow, how to look for properties, things of that nature, this training will walk you through that step by step. I actually just recorded a new version of this training to reflect today's market, today's interest rates, today's rents, things of that nature. It's about 30 minutes and there's even some bonus content in there, 100% free. All you have to do is leave me a 5-star rating and review, take a screenshot of your submission, and send that to me in the email. My email is in the show notes of this episode. So I look forward to hearing from you. Another exciting announcement is that I am hosting a 4-week virtual intensive workshop to teach you how to invest out of state. You can find more information at outofstatemoney.com/workshop. I'm also going to talk about it a bit more at length in just a moment. I'm so excited about this episode. I had so much fun on this episode talking to Terry Harris. He is a former player in the NBA G League who transitioned into real estate. He's done various aspects of real estate, and right now he is a real estate developer working on luxury homes in the desert in Southern California in the Joshua Tree area. And also he's building large multifamilies in Los Angeles. So he has probably about 70 or so units in his pipeline. This interview was so amazing. So I'm not going to hold you up. Let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, subscribe, share with a friend who needs this game. If you're on audio, leave us that 5-star rating and review. It takes about 10 seconds, probably even less. So definitely appreciate your support. Very excited for this conversation today. Here with me, I have Terry Harris. Terry, appreciate you jumping on the show, man.
Man, Sam, appreciate you having me, man. Big fan of the podcast and just happy to share my story.
Thank you. I appreciate it. How you feeling today?
Feeling great, man. Born ready, man. So you told me the podcast was today. You know, I had to get myself ready and feel good.
Definitely. I'm excited about it, man. And shout out to Natasha and Nikki Renault. I interviewed them about a month or two ago, and they shared, they were like, you know, you got to talk to Terry, you got to connect with Terry. So shout out to them for putting you on my radar, man. So I definitely want to make sure I give them their flowers.
Got to, yep.
definitely. Mm-hmm. All right, man. So let's jump right into it. So, Terry, you started investing in real estate when you were in the G League.
Correct.
So just love to hear a bit more about that and why you felt like that was a good time to get started while you were playing pro ball.
For sure. So I started off, I played summer league with the Philadelphia 76ers. And after that, I signed with the Philadelphia 76ers, but they immediately waived me down into the NBA G League. So my contract was with the G League team. And a typical NBA G League season is 6 months. So while I was playing in the G League salary is not that much, $35,000. Wow. So for 6 months, I was always wondering what is going to provide me with financial income and financial stability for the next 6 months of the year. So I was just really eager into finding another source of income. And I remember just like listening to the radio one day and it was like, come to this free real estate thing. And I was like, let me check this out. And I looked some reviews up and I was like, it was a little like, I got mixed reviews online. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go pick up a book on real estate. I went to Barnes and Noble and pick up Brandon Turner, the book on real estate, the book on rental property investing, mm-hmm. The Blue Book by Brandon Turner, Bigger Pockets. And that kind of geared my mind and kind of showed me that I was like, oh, wow, like I can do this right now. I can do this with a $35,000 salary. And so while I was in the G League, anytime we were home, I was just touring houses with realtors and I was doing whatever I can to try to get into real estate. And I remember the first couple tours I did, the realtor asked me, he's like, hey, what are you going to do? What are you going to, how do you look to purchase this? Are you going to do 20% down? Are you going to buy it all cash? Or are you going to do 3% down? I was like, wait, you said 3% down? So then he's like, yeah, FHA 3% down. So I was like, oh, I can do that. And he's like, yeah. So he got me pre-approved and I came to find out like I really didn't have to have that much capital even saved up to go and purchase my first home. So, long story short, I started analyzing a lot of properties. I started speaking to a lot of locals in Wilmington, Delaware, where I was playing and asking what areas were good, what areas were so-so, and, you know, if they thought houses in this area would be good. And I landed on my first property in Delaware. I bought it for $170,000. And the beauty about this one was I was able to put 3% down. So I was to come into the closing table with about a check of about $6,000. And I was able to negotiate seller credits for safety hazards in the house. Mm-hmm. And I was able to get a $10,000 check back for rehab and to fix up the property. So on closing day, I came in with a $6,000 check and I left with a $10,000 check and the keys. So it was just like, it was kind of mind blowing. I was like, oh, wow, I actually just made money and purchased my first house. And from there, I was able to put in about $30,000. I, you know, used a lot of my credit card debt, saved up all the money I had in the G League, used that $10,000 seller credit and put $30,000 into the house. I was all in at roughly around $200,000. And a year later, I was able to sell for $320,000. So I was able to triple my G League salary from one real estate deal. And when I was able to do that, I was like, wow, if I'm 1 foot in, 1 foot out in real estate and was able to do this, what happens if I really take this even more serious? Like, where could it lead me to? And that's kind of how my journey started. Really.
Wow, that's crazy. How many years ago was that roughly?
That was about like 4.5 years ago.
4.5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So you pretty much got paid $4,000 to buy a house.
Correct. Yep.
That's crazy. So how were you able to negotiate that seller credit? Because that's something that people kind of talk about or have questions about. How were you able to get that done?
So every home that you buy or in escrow for, you know, you have an inspection contingency. So during my inspection contingency, we found many safety hazards. And what we told the previous owner was, hey, look, either you can fix these. We have a quote from a general contractor saying it's going to be roughly around $20,000 to fix all of them, or you can credit us $18,000 from the sale of the property. So it wasn't really coming out of their pocket, but probably was coming out the profits. So they countered back at around $7,000, and then we said, okay, can we do $10,000? Let's meet in the middle somewhere. And they said that's fine, and I was able to get that credit because obviously a homeowner, they don't want to do all those repairs. They don't want to bring a contractor in. They'd rather just give you here's $10,000 out of my profit of what I receive from the property. Yeah. We'll give you this and we'll give you this instead of us doing it. And that's how I was able to negotiate that.
Got it. So if somebody's like buying a property and let's say they're noticing whether it's safety hazards or like certain work that needs to be done, if the seller doesn't want to do that work, do you recommend trying to like either negotiate some of that off the price based on how it'll cost or trying to get some sort of credit to people? Mm-hmm.
I definitely recommend it because, you know, if you're a homeowner and you have to do all these repairs before a sale, you're most likely trying to do it as fast as you can and as cheap as you can just to get the property off your hands. So like as a new homeowner, you might as well, especially in today's market, it's not as competitive as it was a year or two ago when rates were at 3%, 4%. So it's like, I would definitely suggest negotiating those seller credits and, you know, getting as much as you can so you can get into your rehab a little, or if you're flipping, so you can get into your rehab like with a bit of a head start.
Yeah, that makes sense. What was your goal when you first bought that property? Was it to flip it at a certain point, or did you think you would like maybe buy and hold it? Like what was the
goal? The goal was buy and hold. The goal definitely buy and hold. I was like, look, I want to receive financial freedom. I want to cash flow, you know, maybe like $500, $600 a month from this one property, and then refinance it, take it, go into the next one. And then like my goal was like every year playing basketball to bring in another real estate asset and start building up this cash flow. So now I know that like, okay, basketball is going to be 6 month season, but I'm still getting paid from these rental properties. So buy and hold was the goal, but you know, I said, look, if the price is right and I can sell for this price, by all means, you know, the return on investment was just, it was a spectacular return on investment. So I was like, you know, I'll let it go at this price. And I was
definitely
let it go.
It worked out. It worked out
for sure.
Was that a single family home or a multi?
Okay. Single family. Yep.
Dope. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the $35,000 G League salaries. So how do guys survive off of that? And what do you do? What do guys typically do for income for the next 6 months? Or do you kind of just try to make things stretch?
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty tough. I mean, one thing the G League does do, though, it's they do pay for your housing. Mm-hmm. They, you know, so you're good with housing. Most of the food is already paid for, travel. You know, you don't really have to spend too much money. And that's most places wherever you play professional basketball. A lot of guys do in the next 6 months, they'll go somewhere else. They'll go to another country or, you know, some guys get a 10-day contract. Some guys able to move up to the NBA team. So it's like, you know, you're not looking just to play in the G League and then just call it a year.
Yeah.
You're probably doing more than that. And you're probably doing most likely going to another league or so after.
Got it. That makes sense. So I know in the NBA, they have like, you know, the rookie transition program, if they still call it that, where you learn about finances and all those type of stuff. Mm-hmm. Do they have anything like that in the G League?
They do. They, throughout my year in the G League, there was a couple like courses and events that they would bring you to, financial literacy, learning how to use credit cards, learning how to, you know, spend that money on the G League, like thoroughly, understanding, look, this is what you're getting paid. You know, you're going to still need this money throughout the rest of the year. This is how you need to really be spending it. And because a lot of times, you know, you're getting this money in 6 months. So it's like if you're getting 35K in 5-6 months, it's like it's almost as if you're making 7-8K a month. Mm-hmm. And then, but that's not really what you're making, because when that stops, it's like, okay, now you have to live off this money.
Yeah.
So to kind of like put that in our heads and, you know, while we're in the G League was like really important. And I think that was like, you know, really vital information for anybody, you know, in the G League.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense. Do you feel like guys were paying attention or participating in those kind of things, or was it some people were interested in that kind of stuff?
I mean, I think everyone, you know, just in, you know, our main thing is basketball. So like our main thing is like, look, I'm here to get a 10-day, or I'm here to move up or whatever. So like, you know, I think the number one priority was basketball. So not too many guys probably were thinking about that.
Yeah. And the reason I ask is because, you know, with all that context, it's pretty rare to have someone who was playing in the G League taking real estate so seriously and leveraging what they were making to get in the game and already thinking ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So what made you think that way? What made you want to go in that route while managing a very demanding career and still figuring out the time to get real estate stuff done?
Mm-hmm. I wanted some ownership, you know, I wanted ownership or something, wanted my own business. I think like with basketball, you know, nothing's really guaranteed. Nothing's guaranteed. The ball will stop bouncing for everybody one day or another. So what I see is a lot of times, a lot of athletes, they'll play for 5, 10, 15 years And when they're done playing, it's like they're at ground zero, you know? It's mm-hmm. it's like, now I got to figure out life. So my thing was like, look, I'm going to figure out life now while I'm playing. So this transition is a bit seamless. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was like, I don't want to be basketball, no matter where you are in the top in the NBA, you are like you're a piece of an organization.
Yeah.
I thought it was really important for me to create something where I'm not a piece, where I'm full control of whatever happens and whatever finances come from it. And it was actually, to be honest, when I was able to sell that home or make some money off that property and make it instead of somebody else giving me a check, it was a big mindset switch. It was like, oh wow, like I can make money if I really try and do this.
Yeah.
Not, oh, this organization's gonna pay me for my efforts, you know?
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So you sell the property, mm-hmm. you got a big check, six-figure-ish range. What happened after that? Did mm-hmm. you still continue to play? Was that around the time you ended up walking away? Well, mm-hmm. talk us through that timeline.
Yeah, so after that, COVID happened. Mm-hmm. So I always do all my training in Los Angeles for basketball. Mm-hmm. So I went to LA, started doing my training. And I stumbled, you know, LA, it's expensive. You know, my first house in Delaware is $170,000, right? So if I'm entry level in Los Angeles, you're probably looking at like $600,000-$700,000 to get in. And I didn't really know the market too well. And I was like, all right, well, let me figure something out. But I stumbled on Joshua Tree, California. Mm-hmm. And I was able to acquire another property in Joshua Tree for $230,000. And I was like, okay, the real estate worked for me. Let's rinse and repeat. Let's do the same thing. So I bought that house for $230,000. I put in about $65,000 in renovations and repairs, put a hot tub in it, made it look nice. And Airbnb was the thing out there, still is the thing out there. So at the time, I was able to lock in a really low interest rate at about like 3.5%.
Goodness.
So all in all, my monthly payment was $1,600 for that property. And that property was averaging about $6,000 a month on Airbnb. So wow. I was like, okay, this is cash flowing like $4,000 a month. And I'm like, one property. So I'm like, what if happens if I get 10 of these? Like that could be really, really life changing. And, I was like, okay, this next move going into Joshua Tree was like, okay, this is the market to be in. And, that was my next transition. And I did a couple flips out there, bought, rehabbed them, sold some, and I bought some land out there as well. The reason why I bought some land was because I saw like, okay, my properties were doing 6,000 and I was using AirDNA data and also talking to a lot of developers and investors out there as well. And, 6,000 a month is roughly around, it was probably doing like around 60 to 70K a year. The new constructions were doing 200,000 a year, 200,000. So I was like, okay, if I'm all in on my house for about $350,000 and these developers are building their houses for $400,000, essentially I could do the same thing and make a way higher cash flow. Now, it's going to take a bit longer. You know, these flips were taking me 3-4 months. New developments take about, you know, from start to finish, 12 to 14 months. But my thing was like, all right, I'm going to do 10 of these. Yeah. So one is done every single month. And it's like a seamless process. So my goal was to acquire as much land as I could out there and to become a developer and to start building luxury single family homes out there. That was also the best product on the Airbnb market mm-hmm. for that area.
Definitely. Wow. So it sounds like there was a turning point. Like you got the flips going mm-hmm. and then it's almost like you made a discovery, right?
Mm-hmm. Like
these guys are building these houses for not that much, but they're able to generate so much more cash renting it out on the short term rentals. So I want to take it back a little bit, actually, because obviously there's stages. So with first property, you put about, I think you said 30,000 or so of work. Mm-hmm. And then you come out here and you go into flips, which I'm sure is a considerable amount more of work to do, and then get into development. So what helped you go through those different stages of rehab? So, you know, doing the smaller one you did, the first property, then on the flips, like how are you learning all this? There's some mistakes made. Talk to us a little bit about that.
For sure. I feel like every project I've been learning a little bit from. So like the first project, I really didn't have the biggest budget. So I was using a lot of, not the, the best of the best contractors. Mm-hmm. I was using kind of just finding, you know, the guys where I can make ends meet.
Yeah.
It worked, but then there was a lot of times where, things backfired. So I was like, all right, the next one, I want to do things the right way. I want to also make it more high end. And, I remember the next one was a lot more landscaping work because I had to make a product. I had to make something for an Airbnb market. I had to do a bit of electrical work. I had to do some plumbing work and just a lot of advanced cosmetic work. So really like new flooring, new appliances, things like that. So it was just, it was a bigger flip. It was more work, but you know, every one you do, you learn a bit more. You learn how to pick the contractors, pick the trades. You learn how to vet out the different contractors. And those are what that's what I was able to learn throughout those, you know, those first two flips. And going into the next flips, the processes were a bit more seamless with learning how to pick contractors, learning how to move efficiently, move in a timely manner. And then I also learned the power of private lending and using construction lenders. So on one of them, I was able to use a construction lender that was, it was about 20% of the, I had to bring in 20% of the acquisition. Mm-hmm. And then they funded the rest of it plus the whole rehab. Wow. And then I just have to, you know, pay the interest on the loan throughout how many months it takes. So now I think that was able, when I was able to learn that, I was able to learn how to scale in a more effective manner by using the right lenders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got it. That makes a lot of sense. So a construction lender, is that different from a hard money lender?
Kind of the same. Private lender, hard money lender, kind of just same, but different terms. Yeah.
Got you. Mm-hmm. What tips do you have for someone who wants to look into like the construction lending side of things?
Mm-hmm. I would consult with the construction lender first. So mm-hmm. you know your terms, you know how much money you're going to be out of pocket. And I would definitely, you know what the interest rate you're going to pay, know your requirements. Mm-hmm. A lot of times people think you need to have so many, you know, you need to have X amount of flips done. You need to have X amount of dollars saved up. But a lot of that's not even the case sometimes, you know, as long as you have a, contradict not having X amount of flips done is having a contractor that's very well versed and very well experienced. The liquidity, sometimes you might just bring in a partner who has the liquidity. So mm-hmm. it's like, I would definitely tell them, you know, when you're going and vetting out your construction lenders, if one says no, that doesn't mean everyone will say no. You know, many times construction lenders have said no, but then there's others who say yes to my terms. Yeah. And, you know, speaking to many, you know, whether it's a construction lender or even just a regular lender when you're buying a property, mm-hmm. Each lender has different guidelines. So don't take no for an answer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely. Something I want your opinion on. So around the country, there's different regulations regarding Airbnb, and some cities are cracking down, others not so much. What's your thoughts on the outlook of the short-term rental space?
I think short-term rentals are, you know, should be operated as a business. So it's like there was a time where you could go in Joshua Tree, you can go and buy a, you know, a regular home and, you know, put some furniture in it and call it an Airbnb and make good money. And during COVID, you know, it was like there was an influx of people traveling out there. But now you really have to know your market, right? So you have to know what amenities you need in a market. And you have to know how to put a great product on the market for Airbnb. It is, like I said, it is a business. So whatever market you get in. So I know for Joshua Tree, my properties, I want a pool because I know summertime, it gets extremely hot out there mm-hmm. and a lot of numbers drop out there. So a pool can mitigate that drop in numbers. I want to make sure I have a modern home, nice modern home that's unique and not like the rest of the homes that are on the market. And then I also want to make sure there's a good amenities and a good size piece of land because people want to be in a spacious area. So most of my lots are above 2 acres. And that just gives the guests, whoever stay there, you know, seclusion and just to really get away from whatever city they're coming from in California or wherever and to feel at peace. So, but that market's going to be different from another market. And you want to, what I do, I go on AirDNA, I gather all the top performing Airbnbs and I see the commonalities that all these Airbnbs have. And from there, I take those commonalities. I'm like, okay, now I'm starting to understand the market. Now I'm starting to understand what makes this product better than this product. And as you start doing that, you start understanding what you need to do to be the best or the, have the best Airbnb in your market. So I think that's what I recommend and anyone looking to go into Airbnbs.
Definitely. And I love that. I love that. I think I agree with you. I think it is important for people, I mean, do market research, figure out how you can stand out in your particular market. And, you know, a lot of stuff out there is very cookie cutter, but you can't take a cookie cutter mentality from Joshua Tree to Seattle or from Seattle to Houston. Like it's all different markets. It's all different things people like who visit there. So I appreciate you mentioning that. And, you know, for those listening, definitely take those things into account if you're looking to get into the short-term rental space.
For sure. For sure.
And as far as like the different regulations and things like that, what are your thoughts on cities that are trying to crack down on short-term rentals?
I'm really not a fan of cities that crack down on them. When short-term rented, so like for example, in Joshua Tree, if you know, there's some cities who cap short-term rentals at about 10%, the surrounding cities. And really what that's doing is that's saying to developers, okay, I'm not going to go in the city, but I'm going to go to the city next door. I'm going to go to this city. I'm going to go to another market. And when they make it difficult, it you know, removes the investors or the developers from coming into the market. And, you know, when Airbnbs were very prominent out there, or when they weren't capped in certain markets, a lot of developers were building new homes, new luxury houses, and new luxury houses only increase a neighborhood or increase the area's value. And it makes the area look really, really beautiful when done in the right way. I think places that need housing have a lot of vacant land, have a bit of crime. I think new housing, new development is only going to help. So I'm for just letting business happen naturally. I can see though, I can really see how a neighborhood will, or a city or community will be mad at an Airbnb being in a legit neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So if you want to regulate, if that becomes regulated, that makes sense. Like if it's in a neighborhood and there's kids in school, you know, okay, you regulate that. I can see that. But in areas where like, you know, there's all bunch of vacant land and just a vacant plot of land, oh man, I guess let that place be Airbnb, man. It's like let people come and develop here. Yeah. You know, the only, and then especially if it's new construction and it's gonna be beautiful, I'm all for it. And like sometimes when you go out in Joshua Tree and you see the views and the you know, just the immaculate landscape that they have, and you see these beautiful homes,
yeah,
it's wonderful to see. And I'm all for seeing more of that as much as possible.
Definitely. So in Joshua Tree, is it an area where mostly people have like second homes and places they come during certain seasons, or is, what's the landscape out there?
There is. Yeah. So there's a lot of Airbnbs and then a good amount of Airbnbs. And then some people do have their second home or their vacation homes out there as well, just to get away and to relax, seclude, and just be away from all the ethnicity of LA or San Francisco or just anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing too is like it stimulates the local economy as well. Because think about it, right? Let's say you're in a place like there where people, you know, have some short-term rentals or maybe just their vacation home. There's going to be a period of time during the year, probably half the year or so, when they're not there. Mm-hmm. So if those folks are not there, who's going to the restaurants, who's going to the store, who's going to Target or whatever the case is.
Exactly.
Or you could allow people to run businesses, mm-hmm. have their short-term rentals, which are giving people jobs who live in the surrounding areas mm-hmm. because they're patronizing all the businesses and stuff. So to me, I think it makes sense. And mm-hmm. I personally think if someone's paying their taxes, if your guests are not being a nuisance to anybody, and if you're not generally being disruptive or your guests are not, then if it's your house, you should be able to do what you want, in my opinion.
I agree. And then another thing that I've seen happening was as the Airbnbs were getting so popular out there, more people were building new construction. And what was happening was the new construction were, you know, they're not, if the best you can get for Airbnbs, let's say $1,000 a night, and these new luxury new constructions are coming in, they're taking that $1,000 night spot. And what it's doing is dumping the ones on the bottom who were just like regular houses in regular neighborhoods. And what was happening was those owners were just selling it to regular people who were buying, or regular homeowners who wanted to buy just to live there. So it's going to naturally get the properties that aren't really supposed to be Airbnbs off the market and have these luxury, the ones that are on big plots of land outside of neighborhood communities, on Airbnb. So
yeah,
I think it just, you know, sometimes you just gotta let things like businesses flow naturally, you know?
Yeah. I'm all for business and people being able to run their businesses, mm-hmm. so long as they're being run ethically and
exactly.
You paying your taxes, you're not bothering anybody, get over it.
Yeah.
people may not like that, but hey, that's what I think, man. So before we dive a bit more into the developments that you've done out there and what you're working on out here, I would love if we could spend some time talking about the process. Mm-hmm. Feedback that I've gotten from folks is they want more explanation of like the development process. Mm-hmm. So if we could maybe walk through that at a high level, what the process is like, and I'm sure as we talk about specific stuff, we'll get a little bit deeper, but if we could just ground ourselves in just what the process is that somebody can expect if they're looking to get into development.
For sure. So the first thing is finding a site, right? So one thing when we look for sites, we're making sure our sites have utilities. And it's super easy to figure out if you have water and electricity or gas if needed. You know, for us in Joshua Tree, it just takes one quick call to the Joshua Tree Water District to say, hey, just want to know if this parcel of land was connected to water. And it's a minute call and they'll be able to confirm that with me on the phone. Wow. And we want to make sure it has water, because if you do buy a lot that doesn't have water, not connected to any type of, public infrastructure, I've heard prices from the water district up to $150,000 to bring in water. So, wow. So most of the time that'll probably break a deal. We want to make sure, you know, that's there. And then we want to make sure there's electricity. So all I do for finding electricity is I look on the satellite map. And if I see that little, electrical pole, I know that we're able to connect to, you know, Edison, SoCal Edison, which is the electric company out there. We know we're allowed to connect to the electrical there. So, those are the two main things I want to do. I want to vet out first. The next thing I want to do is make sure it's in the right price, make sure it's in a good area and it's the right size that whatever I'm creating. If I'm building a home that's just going to be a regular home, I want to know, okay, is this going to be profitable when it's all said and done? Mm-hmm. I also want to check the comps in the area. So I want to make sure, like for me, I'm building luxury houses. I don't want to put a luxury house in an area where only $200,000 houses are being sold. I want to put a luxury house in an area where there's a couple of million dollar homes that are being sold. So now I know that I have comps to support this house as well. And once I can get all those and probably, you know, once I get all that together, I know that it's a go. I check it off on my list and I'm able to acquire it. So a good land out there that I've acquired probably can range anywhere from $25,000 to $50,000. That'll check off all those benchmarks.
If you're someone who lives in an area where it's so expensive to buy real estate and you feel like it's impossible, then I have something for you. I just released a free guide that's going to give you the 8 steps you need to take to buy your first out-of-state property. I bought several properties out-of-state, living in California, investing in Ohio, and you could do the same. It's just a matter of having the right information. So click the link in the description of this episode to get your free guide today.
And then the next thing I'll go and do is find an architect. And I think finding an architect is like half the battle when you are going to do any type of new development. And the reason I say that is because a lot of times when you have this vision of creating a luxury house, sometimes you get veered off or want to hire an architect who's cheaper. But you want to hire an architect who's built the house that you really envision. And the way I say vetting out architects is like, you know, drive around and look at the houses, do a little bit of research. It's not too hard to do the research and find out who that architect was who built that home, and reach out to the architect, let them know that you want to build something and let them know your vision. I even say like, pick the architect that if you can't say anything to the architect about your project, he's going to build something as close as possible as what you think. So that's kind of like, that's how you want to pick an architect. Yeah. And then pick a local architect as well. So the reason I say pick local architects is local architects have a lot of resources. They know how to maneuver through the planning department. They can do it faster. Time is money in these deals as well. So you want to make sure somebody can get through the planning department, you know, efficiently. As soon as you pick an architect now and you get your plans, you know, now you're doing the plan submittal process. You know, in Joshua Tree can take anywhere from 2 to 4 or 5 months, depending how efficient you are. You want to value engineer your project as well. So, I say during the planning process, have your contractor already ready and have your contractor kind of bidding your project out. And the reason why you do this in the planning project, because sometimes we get a little anxious and we want to build something immaculate and it's like put all this glass in the house and do all crazy stuff, but we're really not knowing the cost of the build. So it's called value engineering. And that's basically just in the pre-development stage to value engineer your project so you know how much it's going to cost to build your product. This is super important, and it's a mistake I made on my first home. And I can, like, you know, I'm happy to say it, but I built this house and I love it to this day. I love everything about it. But I built this house that has panoramic glass all around the 360 around it. And I was just like, in my head, I was just like, okay, modern house Joshua Tree, it's going to cost $300 a square foot. That's what my couple developers told me. And this house ended up costing around like $425 a square foot. And I didn't value engineer it at all. When I was done out of the planning stage, I went and got a contractor. And nowadays, every project I do, I make sure I have the contractor ready. Like, hey, what's this one going to cost roughly around, give or take? You know, can you do analyze it? And a contractor is more than likely they're not going to charge you for it because they want your business. Yep. So if they, you know, so that's something that's not going to cost you anything. It just takes a little bit of your time. And then the next thing I do is when the plans are approved from the city, I go to my construction lender. And so the specific construction lender that I have gives me 60% loan to value. So what they'll do is I'll pay for an appraisal and the appraisal will come in and appraise my plans as if the house has already been built. And for example, like one of my homes just got appraised for, it hasn't been built yet, but they appraised the plans for $1,050,000. So what they'll do is give me 60% of that. So 60% of $1 million is $600,000. My contractor already bidded the house out for $550,000. So now almost everything is like, I love this. Almost everything is like in place where we're getting 60% LTV. It covers the cost of the construction loan, the construction financing, and then it covers also 6 to 8 months of interest. We add that inside the loan as well. So I'm no money out of pocket. The only money I'm out of pocket is the cost of the land and the cost of the pre-development. And then it gives me two options now. It gives me an option to build this home, sell it for $1 million when it's all said and done, because that's what the market is appraising it for, or to refinance it at 75 or 70% loan to value. And even if I refinance it at 75% loan to value, it's a burr, you know, buy, rent, refinance, repeat. I'm able to refinance it and cash out a little bit of equity from the project. So it gives me two exit strategies, and I like to have two exit strategies in any deal. So I'm not really forced to do anything, forced to sell. And I noticed that when you're forced to sell, that's when things can get a little shaky and get rocky and you can lose a lot of money. So I like to just have two exit strategies, and that's the way I'll go about, you know, doing that. And then after the bank appraises it, we get the construction loan, and we're using a local contractor, somebody who's built in the area, somebody who can build efficiently in the area. That's very important. Stay local with the contractors, and, you know, stay local with the contractors, and then also get a contractor who's not building cookie cutter homes or renovations, but they've built custom luxury homes before. Yep. That's super important as well. So we'll do that. And then we'll just, you know, we'll oversee the project of the build. And when time gets ready to refinance it or to sell it, we're making sure that we got the ducks in a row, with our bank lender to go and, to refinance it, pay back our construction lender and to move on to the, you know, move on, make it Airbnb or sell it.
Definitely.
Hey, that was a lot, but
that's perfect. That's perfect. I wow. So I feel like I can walk out of here and go develop something myself.
And what I learned about new development was so cool was my rehabs, like the first rehab I did in Joshua Tree, I bought it, I put 3% down, and then I added, and then I did a $60,000 renovation. So it was all in like an $80,000 investment. And all in for the property, I was roughly in about 330. So $80,000 investment, all in 330. With the new construction, I'm all in on one of them. I'm all in 450, but my capital out of pocket was a $45,000 investment. So I'm building new construction for less than I was doing the rehabs and the flips for. So that kind of made it really, really enticing. And I would like, you know, anybody to know, like, you know, new developments, you really, you know, if you do it the right way, you don't need all this excess capital to really invest in it. And then also, like, a new development is going to take longer. It's going to take about 12 to 14 months. So as a flip, 3 to 4 months, you need that 80. You need that 60 to 80K in 3 to 4 months. In the development, you need that money throughout the course of 12 months. So it's like, you know, if you're working a 9 to 5 or you have another income or a business, you know, you're able to just allocate a little bit of funds from that every now and then. And it kind of makes it a bit more easier. And then I enjoy it more because I can be also like creative in the process, and I can like watch something and, you know, vision that I had in my head, hit the piece of paper, you know, see the 3D renderings and then form and come to life. So that's like, for me, that's like, man, that's just the beauty of it, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing, man. So what are some things that stand out or that you like to focus on with when you build these luxury homes?
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for me, I'm a young developer, and I feel like I got to add that flair. I got to add that into my development. So I want all my builds to have like a bit of like a futuristic look to them. So you'll see like in all these builds that they have like, they're just different. They're unique, butterfly roofs, lot glass, just like some wing shaped homes. And it's just me being fun and being creative. It's just like, I don't want to be the norm. I don't want to do anything like, you know, like everybody else, but I want to have fun with it. So yeah. I think, if I can encapsulate that in my builds, it just makes it a super fun process and makes it just super enjoyable for me.
Definitely. Definitely. It's funny. You mentioned just not wanting to do the norm. And I think there's a lot of evidence in your story of that, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you walked away from your basketball career pretty early in favor of like real estate, which most people will probably call you crazy. Most people, I'm sure people did say like, yo, like you tripping, like you got like a career ahead of you, but you saw something. Mm-hmm. You saw like, you know, how much you can make in a short period of time. So there's that. There's obviously like moving across the country and then also, you know, going in the Joshua Tree, which most people probably aren't really talking about. You know, people think about Southern California, they're thinking LA, San Diego, places like that. So, you know, I think you're just building upon what's already inside of you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think, kind of like just moving with, kind of like with instincts of like, you know, you get like a little inclination of like, you know, this seems like the right, you know, it feels right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just keep moving with it and keep moving with it. And it's just like, in these 4 years, you know, me following that little instinct has got me to, you know, be developing 80 plus doors now. So it's like, I think I'm just going to keep flowing with it. Yeah. You know? So, yeah,
definitely.
It's been dope. Yeah,
definitely, man. How many houses have you built out there in Joshua Tree?
Right now we have 12 homes being built out there.
Gotcha.
So currently 4 under construction. 1 just was complete. Mm-hmm. 4 under construction, 4 that are in planning. I kind of like want to go in little phases. So get these 4 done and then, or like get these 4, like, you know, just really like under control and then go on to the next 4. And then I have 2 more that I kind of want to do something special with.
Yeah.
And kind of figuring out what's the best way to kind of curate these next houses. And then now we just started a 27 unit building in LA, and we'll be doing another 42 unit building in LA as well.
Wow. Wow. So for the developments that are in different phases out in Joshua Tree, are you just mostly utilizing construction loans? Have you taken any outside capital from like investors and stuff?
Mm-hmm. So the partnerships, building partnerships has allowed me to scale up. And it's something that in my year one, year two, I was like, I got to establish myself. I got to, you know, kind of do my own thing. And, I didn't really want to bring in partners. And I, you know, it's good to kind of get yourself established, do a couple flips and stuff. But when I was able to bring in partners and show them what I was doing, it allowed me to scale up exponentially. So like the first house I was able to, I bought two lots. And I remember at the time I was getting a lot of lots under contract because I was like really searching. I was wholesaling at the time. And I had two investors who really wanted to check out the lots that I had. And I brought them out to check them out. And they're like, it's not going to work for us. And they didn't know much about the Airbnb game, and they didn't know about construction financing. And I told him, I was like, hey, look, this is actually a really spectacular lot. Like, you know, and I wasn't just selling it to sell it. Like, I was like, I really like, if I had the capital, I would have bought it myself. Yeah. And at the time I had it under contract for $22,000. I did really want it, but I was trying to sell it to an investor for about $45,000. They didn't think it was great. And they were like, well, what are you doing out here? And I was like, well, I got some Airbnbs. And I pull up my phone, I show them the Airbnbs. And they're like, how much are they doing? I was like, I just did $7,500 this month. He's like, that one's making $7,500. And I went and showed them the house. And then I showed them my land. I showed them the plans. And they said, how about this? We have capital. You're hungry. Why don't we buy the land at the price that you have it under contract for? And we'll put the capital up and you run the show. And I was just like, oh my gosh, this is everything I was asking for. Now I can be a developer. Now I can scale up.
Yeah.
And from that, you know, I had two lots, but we bought together about eight lots together.
Wow.
So that was able for me to go from 2 to 10 in the matter of 8 months. And that's just the power of building partnerships. And like Now there's projects where, you know, I get the lot like this one for $22,000. We spend about $25,000 for pre-development, architect, plan submittal, all nine yards, and all in, let's say $50,000. But as me as a developer, I'm in it for $0 out of pocket because I brought in partners and I showed them value and I showed them what we can create throughout these builds. So it's partnerships has been a huge way, and it's really when you scale up in real estate, I think everyone is going to understand like, your team is, you know, you got to have a team and you have to, you know, bring in partners, and it's just part of the game.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And I think, you know, it doesn't surprise me that you've gotten to a point where you can be pretty much minimal or no money out on some of these projects because you have previously bet on yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you took on that rehab when you were on the East Coast, when you were in Delaware, and then you came out here, did a couple flips, cut your teeth a little bit, and then getting into development. You know, I think I would assume like someone looking at you and looking at what you've done on your own, like you just said, you showed them the Airbnbs, you showed them the different things you were doing. They're like, oh, okay, this guy is serious. Like, he's mm-hmm. not just trying to flip this land to me. You know, let's see what we can make happen. So, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that, like, you know, bet on yourself, see what you can do on your own to the greatest extent possible. And then you never know who you could run into, and you know, your track record will speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. For sure. 100%.
Yeah. I think that's special. So, Joshua Tree, you got that going. And so now you are transitioning into LA, which mm-hmm. is a whole different beast.
Whole different
so
beast.
talk about that a little bit and some of the development plans you have in LA.
Mm-hmm. So, when I was in Joshua Tree, there was about three different markets that I was in. It was like Yucca Valley, Joshua Tree, and Landers. Mm-hmm. And I had to maneuver through all these different planning departments. And at first, you know, it was a difficult, like when I first submitted my plans in Joshua Tree, it took about, let's say about probably like 7-8 months. And I was kind of doing it. I was doing all the papers. I was doing all the submittals. I was doing all the requirements. I remember, you know, one of the ladies in the planning department always be like, you're almost there. You're not, you know, we would joke because I was learning every time. And then the next one I was able to do was there 3 months, in and out 3 months. I just knew everything that was needed. I knew what I knew how to maneuver through them. And then, you know, the next, I was in there in 2 to 3 months. And then, you know, there's the city of Yucca Valley that you have to go through as well. So now I'm in another planning phase in a planning department. So I'm learning what they want and I'm able to learn how to maneuver through them. So, and then, I did some properties in Landers, which is part of San Bernardino County, but like I have to go through the Landers Water Department and, you know, do things in there. So I learned how to maneuver through them as well. And I was like, all right, this is, you know, you know, I can maneuver through these three markets. I think I can maneuver through anything now. That's how I'm thinking. And, but the thing is, you're always going to learn. You're always going to need corrections. And you know, there's always things that you're going to pick up on. So I was able to like connect with a lot of developers out here in Los Angeles, and I was able to see, what developers were doing and what they were making for, developing multifamily. And, I was like, all right, this is the next venture, you know, as these houses are starting to be built in Joshua Tree. And I also knew Joshua Tree was at a point, you know, they were going to cap at their short-term rentals, and I would have to venture out and to go into another market. And I live in LA. LA is in my backyard. So I know that market very, very well. I also recommend, you know, new developers to be in the markets that they have access to. So I saw areas, sub-markets in LA that have received exponential amount of growth. And we're looking, and you know, from being in there, you know, they seem as if they're only going to grow further and further along in the future. So, I like East LA, Echo Park, Silver Lake areas, and I think there's so much more growth that the areas can allude to. And LA, of course, we all know there's a lack of supply and a huge demand for housing, and I think apartment housing is like the new norm in like big cities. You know, it is, can you buy a house? Can you rent a house? Yeah. But you know, for people coming and going like they do in New York City and LA, the two biggest markets in the US, apartment living is really like the norm. So if I can come in and fill in a need in a market and, you know, do it at a high level, I think, one, it could financially be, a big game changer. And it can just be another way for me to create and to develop at a high level. So with in LA, I want to not only kind of bring in the concept of Joshua Tree of bringing creative and bringing unique apartment living to LA. I think like a lot of us who are living in apartments are, you know, in the late 20s, 30s, 40s. And I see a lot of these apartments that are plopping up. They're just... we call them gentrification buildings. So one of my architects calls it kindergarten buildings because they just have a strip of like yellow on it or something. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is create housing that's also like people have a sense of pride in living in it. It's not just your regular cookie cutter apartment home, but something that, you know, has a sense of community, like great amenities inside the building. A cool style building where you look at it and say, yeah, that's my building right there. And through value engineering, I don't think it's that exponential, you know, a much of a price increase to create that style. So I think that's what I have to bring in the game as a young developer. That's what I'm looking forward to as I start bringing these apartments and this community type living in LA.
Definitely, definitely. What stage are you in the planning phase, mm-hmm, for those right now?
So for the 27 unit, we just submitted to the LA City Building Department. And for the 42 unit, we just closed on it actually. But we've been working in the last couple of months with a really good creative architecture team. And I'm really excited about what we're going to create here.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. What challenges have you faced in working with the city?
The city of LA?
Yeah.
Nothing as of now. I haven't got corrections back yet. It's still okay. In the early phases. But there are going to be challenges and I'm ready to embrace them. And you're ready to embrace them. But I think the biggest challenges now in developing multifamily is making sure the numbers plan out and they come in at what we want them to come in at. So for single family developments, our valuation of our properties is solely based on the nearest comps in the area. So if houses are selling for $1 million nearby and we're building in the same square footage of them, we're probably going to be comped at $1 million.
Yeah.
For commercial multifamily, if it's not comped off that, the commercial multifamily is comped off how much income your property is producing. Yeah. So we want to make sure, okay, this property is going to bring in X amount of dollars through, and we want to make sure our rents are at market rent. We want to be a little conservative on our numbers, and we want to make sure that the price to build is in line or the margin of the price to build to the valuation of the property is in line to the numbers that we expect. Got it. Those are like that's like the little transition of going from single family to multi commercial development.
Got it. That makes sense. And are these mixed use, or is it just all like apartments in there? Mm-hmm.
One of them will be all apartments, and another one would be mixed use. Got it. We'll have a cool retail space that you know, the whole community in Echo Park can go to, and then also the people in the building can go to as well.
Got it. Love it. So mm-hmm. one ideally in Echo Park, and then what about the other one?
It's in Echo Park as well.
Oh, both in Echo mm-hmm. Park. Okay, cool. Yeah, that's the area that's gone through some changes.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
But that's good. I mean, I think we need more density, you know, we need more housing. So mm-hmm. hey, I think everybody can win. Will they be all market rate?
Mm-hmm. So what I love about what LA does is they have the TOC incentives, transient occupancy communities. And what the TOC does is that if you're near like a public transit system, you're allowed to get higher density, more units, but you have to allocate about 10 to 20% of the building to affordable housing. And so like one of our buildings will have about 3 units of affordable housing, and the other one will have 4 units of affordable housing, and then the rest will be market rate. And what's so good about this is like, you know, a lot of people think like, oh, gentrification is terrible. You're kicking out people who weren't paying market rent out the neighborhood. But like, for instance, one of our properties was a single family house. Now, you know, and it was vacant, but now we're bringing in 4 affordable units plus another 38 market rate units. So it's not like we're really kicking people out, but we're just building more apartments. We're making the community a bit stronger. And the affordable units of the people who lived in the community, who built up the community, are still able to stay within the community.
Yeah, I think that's helpful context mm-hmm. because you talk about there's a single family there right now, and you're building 42 units on there. So 42 families or individuals, whatever, can now live there, mm-hmm. including 4 at a rate they can afford, who otherwise, to your point, would have probably been headed out 100 miles east or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's the conversation people don't have. Mm-hmm. That's the side people don't really share. Because mm-hmm. people will say, oh, well, they're putting this new building up and, you know, it's all market rate housing and there's just a drop in the bucket of affordable housing. But what was there before? Exactly. Where would those people have gone if that mm-hmm. small percentage of people couldn't stay there?
Exactly.
And I think too, like with the affordable housing piece, like developers still have to make money. Mm-hmm. So however it's structured, it needs to still be profitable. Otherwise you can't build.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's different aspects people need to think about, because I think context of everything is important.
Mm-hmm. And I think now, you know, with these incentives and these plans with the TOC, I think the biggest thing really is the buildings that come into the community that don't match the style of the community. So I'm taking it upon myself to build buildings with, I'm a resident of these communities, you know? I, being 27, like I go to the restaurants, I go to the lounges in the community. So it's like, I want to build what the community is looking for. And I think, you know, as more developers, more younger developers come into play in the picture, I think we'll start seeing these buildings that match the community and only make the community stronger. So I'm for it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. So you got a lot going on right now. You got these 2 developments you're working on out here. You got, I think you mentioned like 10 or so in different phases happening out in Joshua Tree. How do you manage everything? Like, what does your team look like? Because I mean, you can't do everything by yourself. So mm-hmm. what does that look like?
Mm-hmm. So my first 2 houses that I built in Joshua Tree, I built them owner builder. So kind of California allows you to do single families. You're allowed to build them owner builder, meaning that you can go and get a plumber, get an electrician, get a concrete contractor and really just sub out all the work. What that did, it was a lot of time for me, but I learned really how to build a home from scratch. If I had a 10-man army, I could build my own house if I wanted to. But it taught me so much, but it was a lot of time. And now as I'm managing more and more properties, what I've done was now, okay, I have a good local GC that can do it. And it's just it eases up a lot of time on my hand. And all I have to do is really invoice the contractor to do what I was kind of doing. And now, making sure for the rest of the builds, I do that. So, making sure you have a good contractor that can manage the builds, that, that I don't have to be, you know, calling every day and making sure everything's going the right way is really important for me. Making sure I have a good architect that's can handle planning and permitting process. The first build I did, I hired an out of town architect and I had to submit the plans. I had to do all the paperwork. Now, when you hire local architects, you know, most of the time they submit the paperwork. They're handling with, the city. They're handling all the, utility departments that you have to deal with as well. So I want to make sure the right resources are in place and team is everything. So I want to make sure that my architect is really strong. My contractor is really strong. My engineers are really strong. And really what I'm doing as a developer, I believe my strongest value is making deals happen. And I want to make sure that if everything else is in place, I'm able to source out more deals, make more deals happen, and just make sure that they run efficiently. So I think the team is really, really key. And it's really important not to try to wear every hat. So, you know, like I wanted to wear the contractor hat on my first two, you know, it helped me learn, but it's not efficient if I want to grow as a developer, to wear the contractor hat. There was times where I wanted to get my real estate license and I was like, I mean, it could have helped, but I'm a developer. Yeah. And sometimes you got to ease back a little bit, know what area in real estate that you really want to lock in and niche on and really move in that nature.
Definitely. That makes a lot of sense. Do you have any in-house support with like day-to-day stuff, or are you mostly like kind of managing most of it and then just the actual work of like building, mm-hmm. just outsourcing a lot of those things?
I have a marketing team that helps me source my deals out. So mm-hmm. I have some cold callers that will go and call up every, in every vicinity of area that we want. And we've been doing that since Joshua Tree to today. And that's helped me source out a lot of great deals. I definitely have a lot of brokers that help me find deals. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Natasha. She helped me find one of our deals. And I think soon it'll be time to get some in-house people to help out. But we're working on getting there.
You're on that trajectory, man.
Yeah,
sure. Soon enough, it's going to be too much for you to handle.
Right.
Man, so how do you keep yourself on track, keep yourself balanced? Mm-hmm. You know, you're 27, you've been able to accomplish a lot at a young age. And I mean, I can only imagine what the next 5-10 years would look like for you. How do you keep it all together?
Man, that's a good question. That's a great question. I like to implement a lot of things that help me become efficient in basketball and take me to the next level in basketball into the business world as well. So like, I remember, you know, when I would wake up early and get a morning workout in at like 6 a.m. Basketball, or like they call it sometimes activation, like before games, like Bron, all the big guys, they do like an activation where they go in the gym, they get a lift in, get the blood flowing, and then they'll ease up, rest up for the day. And then they're ready for the game and to attack the game. So I make sure I wake up at like 5:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. I like to get my mind right. I read a lot. And then, I go do hot yoga where I can get a physical workout in and get the mind ready for the day. And that usually gets me activated to really handle whatever tasks I have to do. And, I think that's huge in my day to day to also, you know, stay physically fit. And then, I think the last year or so, I've been really like locking in a lot of, mindfulness and, being able to implement, you know, just to create and to manifest everything that I've been put in place in life and to really be confident in everything that I'm doing. So, I'm a strong believer in like, you are what you attract. So every morning I wake up and tell myself, you are the best developer. And, I think when I keep telling myself that, you know, good deals start to flow to me, you know, good deals start to flow to me. I'm able to grow more. I'm able to grow at an efficient rate. And, I think that is, you know, that's been huge to really lock in on that and to really stay focused on really what my task at hand is. So that's the things I've kind of been working on.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. So what one thing that I know people struggle with before we close, I want to talk about this, like what is two or three tips you have for someone who wants to get into the development space? So we learned about the construction loan, so we have that down. But when it's time to raise that outside capital, what are some tips that you have for someone who's afraid and just mm-hmm. trying to head in that direction?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing is, you know, you're never going to know everything about the development. You're never going to know everything. Things like even the biggest developers, they go through hiccups. So it's like, if they're going through hiccups, what do you think you're going to go through, you know? And they've been doing it for like X amount of years. So, a lot of times it's like, a lot of times, to be honest, if I knew everything I know now about my first development, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I was able to learn so much and I was able to grow so much. But, and it's just, you know, you have to just kind of just go at it, just go for it. If it feels right, you know, and you, if it feels right and you put your whole passion, you put everything that you, and you believe in it, you put your heart to it, you can never, in my opinion, you can never go wrong. So I suggest kind of just going after it, you know, do all the research that you can do, you know, get all the lenders in place, get your architect in place, build a whole team, build a whole formula, and just go after it. I'm a strong believer, man. If you just go after it, you're going to learn on the way. And it's just going to be a fun process. So enjoy it. Even today, like I go through a lot of stresses about it left and right. And, I remember, I had a good contractor friend. His name is Tang, and he would help me out. And he was a GC in the area in Palm Springs. And you know, I would give him insight on the market. Like, this is good. This is what you need here. And I would give him values back, and he would come and check on the property. And I remember one time I was like, dang, I'm so stressed. The inspector's not passing me. This is crazy. He was like, brother, relax. He said, you're developing. It's supposed to be fun. Enjoy it. And like, to this day, it's like, you know, I'm making conscious effort to like, yo, just enjoy it. Have fun. And, I think when you're able to do that and just enjoy the process behind it, you know, it can take you to like heights that are unlimited. So, for any new developer, you know, it's a fun process. You know, you're creating something, you're creating a vision. I just said, go for it. You know, you never, don't think you are going to know everything. You're not going to know everything, but the fact that you're going and you're, you know, you did the right due diligence. You did what you can, you put it all into it. I think you'll be in a good situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, this has been a really, really great interview. I think just thinking about where you started from in the G League and something just hits you. You're like, you know, I want to invest in real estate while I'm in the G League, and you get that first property, you sell it, you make your way out to California. You start wholesaling, you start flipping, and now, you know, you have all these amazing developments, that some that you've done and a lot in the pipeline. And I just think it's a great story of consistency, of perseverance, and just like getting after it and figuring things out. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a domino effect, right? You've been able to just do more and more in a relatively short period of time, talking four and a half years. And so, you know, this is going to be great value for all the listeners. And I know they're going to enjoy this and really get a lot out of it.
For sure. For sure. No, I appreciate you having me, man. This is definitely a great conversation.
Absolutely. So before we close, let the people know where they could find you and tap into everything you have going on.
Mainly Instagram, Terry Harris 15. I do have a YouTube page. I kind of took a break from it to like, you know, really lock in on the development. So I'm about to start like revamping it up. YouTube page, T Cash. And, you know, Instagram, I'm really active and I'm posting a lot about my projects, you know, every day. And, posting just good content on just the industry in general.
Absolutely. We'll have those linked in the show notes. And thank you to everyone for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. If you're on the audio side, make sure you take a moment, leave us that 5-star rating and review. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like, share, and subscribe. Thank you all so much. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. and the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.